All right, now when we let's pick ourselves back up where we were when we left off there, dealing with this issue of David extolling this final issue or virtue or matter of intelligent sonship prayer, especially when it comes to living those daily lives that we have and taking the doctrine and having it become second nature to us, and really to the point where matters are getting permanently and sensitively written upon our heart to where we don't even have to even discuss the decision process with our Father anymore. It's almost like it's second nature to us, as if and appears to be automatic, even though it's not that, but it almost appears that way. That wraps up in that great phrase in verse 13 of the 139th Psalm, "For thou hast possessed my reins." And that's the last thing the Father wants to see in us, and we get to really rejoice with him when we can tell him, "Look, this thing that you've been teaching me, it's now permanent. It's a daily occurrence with me, and you, Father, have now taken possession of my reins. My desire is to do things your way, and I'll do it. I'll do them your way from now to the day I die. I'm going to do them that way from now on." And so you make decisions and take actions, therefore, in a lot of these things that are going to be in a sense, and I only say that in a sense to get the point across, independent of him, so to speak, because that doctrine has taken possession. You become that living epistle, and conform to the image of Christ. And the genius of the way our Father has actually crafted this curriculum for our sonship education is that it can be, in all reality, as if he takes hands-on possession of you. It's a real hands-on thing. He's right there with you, even though he's not physically standing there. He really does personally attend to your education. I can tell you, and this is bad for me to tell you, but when we first went over sonship education back in Romans 8, 14, and 15, and we're just talking about sonship orientation and all those kinds of things, there were things that I said at that time that, looking back on it, it was almost like I was just saying it because it needed to be said. It was a matter that needed to be said. But now how real it has become. I hope it's been that way with you too. When I was almost trying to convince you and convince myself by convincing you that our Father really does personally attend to our education. And it's like, well, how in the world would he do that? Well, now that we're into it and we see how the machination, how it works, it produces that. The curriculum has the ability and capacity to produce that personal attendance to our education. And were it not for the matter of intelligent sonship prayer, that personal attendance to your sonship education, folks, simply will not take place. That's where that personal attendance occurs. And it's critical that that takes place, and that's going to be one of the ever-increasing aspects of your sonship life as we go on. Well, then we have David going on to say what he says there at the end of verse 13 and on down through verse 16 when he turns his attention then to the matter of, "Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb." And because of that, he adds, "I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book," we talked about the book of my members, the book of your members, "in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them." And so here in this particular part, as David finalizes these matters, he kind of looks back on the issue of the fact that from the time that he was ever conceived in his mother's womb, he was in all the developing stages of it, and science puts names to them, egg and zygote and fetus and all the. God doesn't put those, scientists come up with those names. But David simply looks at the fact that when he was in his mother's womb, in all of its developing stages, before his fingers were like fingers and they were just little bitty nubs, and before his lungs were fully developed and his voice box couldn't carry any sound yet, before any of those things took place, as he was in that mother's womb developing, that when it came to all his members and all that he is, he takes a lot of, we're not going to go into all of this because we don't really have time for it. It may not be germane, but you look at the amount of space he gives to this. He gives several verses to this. And one of these is a very famous verse that Christians like to quote all the time. But he's making a big deal out of the fact that when it came to his members and all that he is, that this life he's enjoying now as he's kind of being put on display as what a son would be to the Lord, his capital to Jehovah God, his heavenly Father, that there's a real father-son connection and relationship, that when it comes to all that he is, this life as God's son, to think like him, live like him, and labor together with him. David talks about this, and this isn't a mystery aspect. This is in Israel's program as well. But this is what I was made for. This is why God formed me. This is the ultimate of why I was ever made. David extols his appreciation for the fact that he was made to be God's son more than anything else. And I want you to know something. You think back about that, if you let your mind go back there and think about that guy, probably as much or more than any other Old Testament character is written about David than anybody else, right? I don't think there's anybody that even is close to having more written about him than David. Of the details of his life from the time he was a boy to the time that he was king to the time that he died, his whole life is chronicled. And so when David says this, in view of what you know about him, even if all you've got is a Sunday school understanding of David, you got something. You think about David saying this, coming out of his mouth, when it comes to why I was ever made, what I was made for, it's this. This, more than anything else, is why I was made. And for David to say that, and extol that being God's son is why I was made more than... That, listen, this includes him being a shepherd. He was probably the greatest shepherd, human shepherd of all time. And he was, when it came to him being the great protector of the sheep, what did David do? You remember this from your Sunday school. What did David do to protect the sheep? He killed a bear. He is the great lion killer and the bear killer. Not Davy Crockett, not Daniel Boone, but David. He killed lions and bears. There's a bear running around in Kerry right now. This is just a little black bear. I wouldn't want to get within 100 feet of the dumb thing. David killed it. He killed a lion of all things. Yeah. To protect those sheep. And sheep are the dumbest animals on the face of the earth. They're the dumbest quadrupeds there are. He was the great protector of the sheep, the bear killer, the lion killer. David was a musical genius. David could write the greatest music that a human pen has ever written. I can guarantee you, 5 billion years from now, when we're finally functioning as a creature, nobody is going to be talking about the Beatles, but they're going to be talking about the 139th Psalm. Now you say, well, God is the author. True. David, however he could sing, and whatever chords he could put together, could calm the insane. He could bring peace to an insane mind. Oh, I'd love to hear David sing. I can't wait to meet him, and I'm going to pester him to sing me a song. That's what he did to Saul when Saul lost his mind. He could calm Saul's heart. He was not only a musical genius, he was a killer of the Philistines. He had so well learned his craft at protecting the sheep that he slew Goliath. And when he picked up 5 stones to kill Goliath, that wasn't because he had little faith. Or, oh, that's where David, he should have only picked up one. Goliath had four brothers, and he intended to kill all five of them. He only got to one before they ran away in fear of a skinny, ruddy little shepherd boy. That when they tried to put the armor on him, it was so loose, I could just see that all just jangling around. He threw it all down. And he said, I'm going to go out there with the thing that I'm skilled at, with this sling and a stone. And then he took Goliath's huge sword and relieved him of his head, put it on a pike and sang a song about it. David was a great warrior. He was actually a military genius as well. He could conduct battles, and he knew how to conduct battle. And he knew the strengths and weaknesses. I learned something about battle this week, just within a week, that I thought rather curious. Do you know why the infantry is called the infantry? What is the root word to infantry? Infant. Babies. That's how the cavalry viewed you if you had to go afoot. Originally, the cavalry that was on horseback, they were the kings of battle. But if you had to go on foot, well, that was for people who weren't skilled at riding horses. They called them babies, infant. That's the infantry. But David could fight in any terrain at any time. He knew tactics. He was a military genius. And on top of all of that, he was the greatest king that Israel ever knew. His son couldn't even eclipse him. David was the greatest king of Israel until Jesus Christ. Until Jesus Christ sits on the throne of Israel, David stays as the greatest king Israel ever had. In fact, Jesus Christ is called David's greater son, greater even than Solomon, greater than David himself. So all I'm doing in this is David says, more than all of that, you take all of that, that's not what I was ever made for in my mother's womb. What I was ever made for was to be God's son. Nothing excited him more. His desire was not eclipsed by anything else that he did. And nothing he could have ever said about himself could have been put at a higher level than that. That's what I was made for. That's why you have the richness of the language that he uses here. Thou hast possessed, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee because of that. For I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. I'm not made like an angel. I'm made like a human being who has the capacity for godlikeness, godliness. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. I'm saying this is one that this stuff has worked. David is talking about here more than anything else, being conformed to his heavenly Father and having his Father's heart become his heart, having this doctrine written on that heart. That's what I was ever made. And I know it. I know that's what I was made for. And that phrase, by the way, that's so often memorized by Christians, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made, that is said smack dab in the middle and in light of the context of David's sonship education taking place and being conformed to God and therefore being able to emulate the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, to emulate Jehovah. Man, those Israelites that lived under that law, they couldn't do that. David is given that kind of glimpse of what being a beneficiary of the new covenant is going to be like. And it's not like being like the rest of Israel was under tutors and governors. David's fearfully and wonderfully made for that reason. Not simply because his eyes are so fashioned that they can actually see things in color. Wow, I'm, and you hear that often. And even Christians will say, well, look how fearfully, look at this eye chart. Aren't I fearfully and wonderfully made? It's not in that context. You're not fearfully and wonderfully made simply because your heart is this incredibly efficient pump that achieves a particular level of heat and doesn't destroy itself with heat and can pump gallons and gallons and gallons of blood over the course of your lifetime in such a marvelous way that it curses through your body to give your body life-sustaining oxygen, then it returns back in its circulatory system to go through the lungs, the pulmonary system, to put off the carbon dioxide that it's gained and receive the oxygen that the rest of your body needs, and you don't even give a thought to that, and you come along and your knees buckle and you say, oh, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. It's not for that reason. That's tiddlywinks compared to what he's doing in your inner man that you can't see under a microscope. And David knows that. Not because he has a brain that can tell the parts of his body what to do and they do it, or any other thing that is so commonly said about this passage. He's fearfully and wonderfully made in view of how God can instill his heart into David's heart and how he can receive this sonship education. And David sees his life come to fruition for what God ever wanted him to be in that moment as he's writing this psalm. And that's the whole reason he was fashioned as a man. And David extols that the whole purpose of man is godliness. That's why we're here. Being produced in him, making decisions based upon the information his father taught him. I said that because my father taught me to say it. I did that because my father taught me to do it. And then he goes out and chooses paths to go, and his paths and the course of his action it matches the very course of action that God himself would take. And that a man comes out of the womb, listen, every man and woman comes out of the womb designedly fit for just that thing to take place. No monkey does. No puppy does. No kitty does. No dolphin does. No whale does. A man does. A woman does. A human being comes out of the womb designedly fit. The moment they draw the breath of life, they are now, even before that, that when they were being formed, they are uniquely designedly fit for this very thing to take place, godliness. The problem is, they're not spiritually fit for that to take place when they're born or when they're in their mother's womb. But what David's extolling is, he was designedly fit for this purpose. Granted, not spiritually. Every man and woman is designedly fit to be educated by God. They're made that way. I don't care if you're dealing with a cave-dwelling Indian in Yuki Indian in South America, or if you're dealing with an Aborigine on the backside of Australia, or if you're dealing with a senator from the United States. They were designedly born for godliness, fit for godliness to take place, to be educated by God. But, and it's a big but, men are born without spiritual fitness, and they are in need of that. That's why that should be the greatest ministry you have to your father. They're in need of spiritual fitness, and you carry the message they need to respond to. The death, the burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Unashamedly, unabashedly, and without intimidation. Folks, that's going to be the name of the game. The fight that we're going to have to face is intimidation. 90% of what that adversary is going to throw at you and me is going to be intimidation. And if intimidation can cause shame, it can cause you to shut your mouth. And that's all he's after. And it's always intimidation. But David reflects this most beautifully here, that this is what you made me for, Father, in the womb, and now it's coming to pass. And therefore, the final issue in having your heart searched in the purpose for intelligent sonship prayer is that issue of recognizing that the personal nature of God Himself made me for being educated by Him as His Son. And every matter that becomes permanently written upon your heart, and you can actually go out and implement, even though He may want, he could stay where He is, and you'll go out and implement it as if you were Him. It really does happen. It's like you look back on it and you say, you look back on what you did and you realize, I did that because my Father taught me to do it. And that's what I was ever made for. And what you walk away with is the most precious commodity, or one of the most precious commodities you'll ever have in your possession. Godly satisfaction and contentment. That's what I was designed for. I wasn't necessarily designed to have a lot of friends. You can say, well, you sure came to the right place. It takes a great amount of godly sonship edification to get to the point where, like the Apostle Paul, you could sit in the Matatiron dungeons of Rome and sing with joy. Say, well, you don't have a friend in the world, Paul. I have something that you can't see. I have a relationship. My Father knows right where I am, and it's as if He's right here with me. And it's not pie in the sky. It's not some kind of ephemeral thing that we just conjure up because we've heard a good sermon. But that's been done through the test and the trial of blood and sweat and tears. And now all three of them apply to Paul. Our recruiting poster doesn't have a chiseled chin young American in that magnificent blue and red Marine uniform. Our recruiting poster, our Uncle Sam doesn't have some red, white, and blue cap hat on it looking like our grandpa waving a bony finger at it. Our recruiting poster, as we follow the ensample of our apostle, is an emasculated, beat up, squeaky voiced little guy that most people would be scared of if they looked at him. He looked like the filth of the world, and yet, when you're weak, then you're strong. Now again, no son goes out and looks for it. Just live as a son; it'll all come to you. Well, that's a very personal matter. And I just leave this section with that issue, that it's hard for me to teach this without getting excited because of how personal it is to me. But if you look at verse 13 again, and I'll try to emphasize the personal pronouns. For thou hast possessed my reins. They've been talking about anybody else but him. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. And even verse, how precious are thy thoughts unto me, O God. It's very personal. By the way, I just want to mention one thing. I probably mentioned this before, but I don't remember. Just as a technical matter, when David says there in verse 15, my substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest part. Lowest parts of the earth there doesn't mean that David was formed in hell or somewhere down in the core of the earth. That's a that's a perspective from God's perspective in the third heaven. And as he looks at his creation, and he looks where earth is and where David was conceived and formed, it's the lowest parts of his creation where earth is. Which is all that's saying there. It's not anything more than that. That's just a little technical thing. But anyway, let's try to move on here and finish this up very quickly. Verses 17 and 18 come along then, and David extols this magnificent praise of God for these things. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me. And we've talked about that before. O God, how great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. That whole personal attendance is always there. I'm still with thee. You and I are together in personal attendance. And David blesses God here. That's what he's doing. He's blessing him. He's speaking well of him. And expresses his gratitude for this personal and very intimate relationship he has with God, being his father and David being God's son. David's been extolling how precious his thoughts and words are to God, but now the reciprocation is, God, you've taken my words. Those are precious to you. You'll listen to every word I say. I can't out-talk you. And you'll hang on, cling to every word that I'm saying. You've demonstrated how precious my words are to you. Now, in reciprocation, how precious are your words to me, Father? To make this whole thing real and live. And so he's now reciprocating that. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God, how great is the sum of them. David expresses his enhanced and his advanced understanding and appreciation for how all this godliness took place. And the way by thy thoughts, O God, is how it took place. It was because God had made us so that we have this capacity, because of the way we were marvelously and wonderfully made, to both think God's thoughts, and not just think his thoughts, but to be able to have created in us the very way in which God forms a thought, the way he thinks. To have God's small case s spirit developed in us. And that allows for us to conduct ourselves and to behave ourselves just like he does himself. And ultimately, of course, to work and to labor with God in all God's business and be successful in God's business with him. And success in our own business, whatever that business is, whether you're actually in business or you just have a job, or whether you're just a student or whatever those things may be, success in our business, our success in any other realm, simply doesn't fulfill what our heart or what our substance, as David talks about, or our members of our body were ever designed for. It won't fulfill that. As much as you try. This is why sons never look at an athlete or a star, a movie star or a song star, scratch their head and say, well, heavens, they had all the money in the world. How could they screw their life up so bad? My son knows. That stuff isn't what you were made for. You weren't made to be famous. Thank God for that. You were made to be infamous. No, I'm just kidding. You weren't. That's more likely where it's going to wind up, but not in the eyes of your father. Some would say that that's how Jesus Christ wound up. But success in whatever or what are by any other standard than that we are being educated, trained to think, live, and labor with our father in his business simply is failure. In view of being educated as son, success in any other, by any other standard, is failure to a son. It's just that simple. You can succeed in every other realm you want to think of, but to a son, that's failure if he hasn't succeeded as his father's son, to be educated and trained by him. And ultimately, the son expresses his desire to go on, therefore, to the next attainment. That's what this praise to God is about here. And then he's going to express that desire to go on to the next attainment. And in his sonship education, and what our Father wants to see in us as he searches our hearts on that kind of day-to-day matter, that as we're gaining the education, gaining the experience, utilizing the information and wisdom, utilizing the information and justice. And by the way, in order to make a just decision, you have to have wisdom first, right? Every just decision you make is actually a wise and just decision. It's not just. It's wise and just. And every decision we're going to make in judgment is a wise, just, judgmental decision. Because it takes those matters to be able to get, because godly love had to be developed through all of them. But ultimately what our Father wants to see is that he's taken possession of our reins, and you acknowledge that. That's what your desire is in connection with any particular education issue, whether it's the first, second, third, fourth, fifth component of wisdom, sixth one, or whatever. But that's the desire. He's now got your reins. Then the excitement, the zeal and enthusiasm that you've seen your life work out. Every part of this is designed to work out through you. You can't be educated as a son and simply remain stagnant. It works out through you. The doctrine's designed to work itself out. And as it does that, you express that excitement and zeal is there to see your life change and matter and be now formed into exactly what God designed for and made for you to be in the first place. You can look back and say, I don't care if it's just a few little things like that. You can look back and say real change has taken place. And if it hasn't, something's wrong. You're not ready to go on. And that leads to that final matter of the readiness and desire to go on to the next attainment. So David gives his praiseful expression and gratitude for this intimate relationship. And then in verse 19, you have that shift that I talk about take place. And that's going to lead us to where we're going to go on Sunday morning. Verses 19, 20, 21, and 22. You have him coming along and saying, "Surely thou wilt say, slay the wicked. O God, depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men. For they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? Am I not grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies." And David, as we have noted before, this psalm is going to be actually picked up and utilized by the remnant out here in the Lord's day of wrath at a particular time in which they're already made aware of the fact that there's going to be a time in which they're going to have to fight. And they're not going to be turning their plows their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. They're going to be doing the exact opposite of that. They're going to take their farm implements, turn them into implements of war. And one of the things that the remnant is going to have the privilege of doing is fighting alongside the Lord and his angels when he is performing those mandates of the Davidic covenant that have to do with him being their deliverer and their avenger. And that's when this is going to come into play in their program. So it is very sensitive to God's program with Israel, and it's in perfect alignment and accordance with the shift that's going to take place and the way in which God's going to deal with his and Israel's mutual enemies, and it's all in line with that particular program. But then the psalm ends with another searching. In light of that shift that takes place there in verse 19, when David now stops talking about what has taken place and is now specifically going to look at future down the road decisions to take a particular course of action, he lays out his thought on it, his course of action that he's going to take. And at the end of it, verse 23 and 4, he says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." And those verses right there are the ones we're going to spend at least a little bit of time on. That's this second searching. There's two searchings that takes place in the 139th Psalm. One at the beginning that deals with everything he's doing down until he makes that shift in verse 19. And then this second searching is in view of that. And a second, different than the first searching, has to do, so to speak, with tomorrow's paths. The course of action yet to be taken. Maybe not just even tomorrow, but maybe a month from now or 6 months from now or in the future. This is what my future plans consist of. And this is where we're going to, beginning on Sunday, I just want to review these two verses that we went over when we were here last in Romans chapter 8, and in light of verses 26 and 27, and searching that is going to take place when the Spirit does the searching, as because we have an infirmity where we know not what to ask for as we ought. That, I think, needs to be said and stated, at least to some degree. We may not go over every detail that we went over, but it's going to now, I think, be much more readily grasped as to how that searching is going to take place now that we're actually in the curriculum. We've got not only information to work with now, we've got labor-intensive information to work with, plus we have at least a modicum amount of having our Father's small case S spirit generated within us, so that you should, and again, I'm not trying to put you into a position that makes it so that you're discouraged, but to some small degree, you should be able to live your day in light of Romans chapter 12, verse 3 through 13 and verse 7. Through receiving the instruction of wisdom and justice, you should be able to live your day and either on two fronts, you can find yourself in a position where you may be around Christian colleagues or Christian friends or Christian family, and you should be able to almost have it ring like a bell go off in your head when you hear somebody say, in light of something that would fit perfectly with having some wisdom or justice on the matter, when they say something so inconsistent with that it triggers a thought in your head where you say, you know, not that you would verbalize it, but that you would say, you know, a son wouldn't think that. Or you see a believer do something and you say, you know, a son wouldn't do that. Or here's the big one. You catch yourself and you realize a son wouldn't have said what I said or have done what I did. That's good. That's what I'm after. That you have a modicum of that, because that's playing on, or that is generated from, a particular spirit that you have within you. That even though it may not be spelled out in detail in the Bible passages you have, you realize, well, a son wouldn't think that way about his government. An educated son wouldn't say that. Good, because that's going to grow and build, and that's going to be integral to some things that you and your Father are going to settle out when it comes to having your heart searched this way. And you have information to operate on. You have a certain amount of his spirit to operate on. And therefore, he's got some means by which he can make an assessment of your request. Search me. Know my heart. Try me. Know my thoughts. See if there be any wicked way in me. Lead me in the way everlasting. This has everlasting benefit. This is where my sonship training for the creature is all about. Now, David's wasn't being trained for the creature, but he was being trained for an everlasting kingdom on this earth. Well, I think we need to finish off sonship prayer by at least addressing this particular issue, and it's going to be, again, good for us. I hope you don't think of me like Sammy Davis thought of his sergeant, as a mean, hateful man who just makes you polish your bullets every day. But believe me, when the battle really is on, this is where we're going to be and spend an awful lot of time in sonship prayer, and it's going to become one of the greatest weapons you ever had to make decisions just like your Father would make them. So we'll stop right there, and we'll continue on Sunday morning with our heads bowed. Father, we thank you for this.